This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahman, and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences, and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutin, we critically unpack theories, frameworks, and social phenomena to better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text, theme, or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. Unfortunately, Sharat can't join us today, but here to take up his mantle is Azif Aizuddin.
Hi,
welcome, man. Those who followed the show will recognize your voice. You're quite a regular here. You've been on the show a few times. But first of all, I want to congratulate you on air for your recent engagement.
Oh, I thank you for
it. How does it feel now?
Feels different. I guess engagement is just a label. The real change, I think, comes when you get married.
Well, that's happening soon.
Next year.
Reception and stuff. All right, yeah. Cool. Yeah, maybe we'll have you on a separate episode talking about, you know, the politics of marriage or the joys of marriage even.
Plus,
you know?
5 years after I get married.
Great. I want to talk about abjection today, Azif, and particularly through the works of Julia Kristeva, who's really popularized this term in the social sciences and the humanities. Typically, what we understand that word to mean usually refers to, you know, things like things that evoke disgust, you know, and this is a primal kind of disgust. The kind of disgust, you know, just to illustrate what we're talking about here, maybe the kind of disgust that we feel immediately when we smell vomit. Or we smell feces. But more than just these biological or separate moments, I want to show how Kristeva makes us think about this in a broader kind of social context, you know, how the same kind of disgust sometimes can be expressed towards the poor or the refugees, so on and so forth. What comes to mind when you hear of this term? Because I know you're a reader of theory as well. What are some of the things that occur to you when you hear about abjection?
Well, when I hear about abjection, I think about our very natural disgust towards things, right? And I read a bit on Julia Kristeva's theory and in her book Powers of Horror, and the idea is, the basic idea is how we reject our mother, and that's very, I think, if you follow the theme of psychoanalysis, Freud, Sigmund Freud coined it, Lacan coined it, and the idea is that when you separate from your mother, which is kind of like a natural, your mother, the maternal figure, your mother suddenly, the maternal figure suddenly becomes a figure that is unnatural towards you. So we start seeing menstruation, the role of women, as an object, but not as a maternal being. You know, they just become something else, and we feel disgust towards something which is supposed to be maternal, something which is supposed to be natural.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point that you mentioned. Well, a couple of points. The first is that Kristeva is working out of a psychoanalytic framework, and she draws from Lacan and Freud. Just for some background to some of the things you said, psychoanalysis traces a lot of our psychological disposition to our experience of infancy, like early infancy. She does make mention of particularly that process where abjection even begins as an experience is that moment when you start conceiving yourself as separate from the mother's body. So you become an object in a sense that you start forming an ego, you start forming an idea of who you are, you have a mental image of what you're supposed to look like, what you're supposed to be. But this happens at the cost of jettisoning, getting rid of bodily stuff, right? So the easiest example would be cutting off from the mother's breast. You're no longer needing your mother's milk. You're no longer attached to the texture of your mother's skin. You know, your tears are no longer rubbing against her and stuff like that. And you develop into a clean person, right? You start wearing clothes. And so it's this process that Kristeva points to when he wants to show how is it that we get these irrational disgusts and how is it that it still creeps up?
Well, if you look at the psychoanalytic, and this is something which we learned in class, right? Which you had at Scuola Falsafa, I think, which we had a psychoanalysis class for about a few months. What we learned, at least, is this idea where you move from the maternal to the paternal. And if you look at it from a larger picture of society, you move away from what is your very primal nature to how society wants to construct you. So you enter you enter a world of laws, you enter a world of social order, which is generally centered around the idea of man and how man wants to shape the world. And
yeah,
love.
I think menstruation is a very interesting account, right, of a moment when we do encounter abjection. I mean, there's still, if you look at certain discourses, religious discourses about the place of women in houses of worship, they'll say that the reason why you don't want to desecrate those houses of worship is because, you know, women who are undergoing their period are carrying, you know, filth and stuff like that. So, and that's a burden that men don't have to carry.
And I think it's interesting when we look at horror films, at least to my knowledge and having watched a few horror films along the years, is when we look at women and how they are perceived in horror films, there's this, if you look at local films, Pontianaks, where women inherently become demonic beings by virtue, and when they die, right, and they're not inherently human anymore, and how we view women in that sense, Pontianaks are women in general. Or when we look at movies such as The Conjuring, which was released I think about 2 years ago, the mother becomes the mother, not a woman, but the mother in that sense becomes a vessel for the demonic being that possesses her, and then she doesn't. Her features change to become something of disgust. Her nails grow longer. She has a waxy, white face, and which becomes unnatural, like human, almost non-human in that sense. And
to be fair, there are, you know, male monsters as well, right? Yeah. Frankenstein or Dracula, for example. But there is something, a different register to horror that women symbolize, you know, unfortunately. And Kristeva points this to that primal moment when we do associate a kind of clarity and pristineness to our personality, right? We don't think of ourselves as dirty. And dirtiness, you know, the idea of defiling and desecrating, takes on added resonance or value. We draw borders, we draw boundaries to highlight inside and outside what's dirty and what's clean. I mean, I have in mind now, since we're bantering about this, you know, earlier this year, was it when there was a lot of fuss around porcine DNA in Cadbury.
Yes, that's true.
In Cadbury chocolates, right? And then you start wondering, how is it that people can get so obsessed about it? And that's another moment where, I mean, abjection takes the form in our culture.
Yeah, I remember one instance where there's one man, and this came out on video, right, where this one man was crying to the camera and he said, is there a way to clean my blood? And because in Islam, at least, the way in which if you interact or engage with an unclean, like pork, for example, right, or pigs, you essentially have to do samak, where you have to clean it using using dust and water. But in the case of blood, where it becomes a part of you, this man now, you can see the tears coming from his eyes and his voice just calling out and saying, help us, you know, help us find a way to clean our bloods, where there's so much disgust with something which is natural, which porcine at the end of the day, it was proven that it wasn't even in the DNA, it wasn't even in the general Cadbury chocolates anyway.
Even the case of halal trolleys, right? The idea that you have to have separate trolleys now because trolleys that are desecrated or tainted by pork or other non-halal things are not fit for use, right?
And those are mostly cultural constructs, right? Yep. Where certain animals who are seen physically unclean, like dogs or pigs, eating from trash or so forth. But can we say that it also extends perhaps beyond the animals, beyond items, but maybe to humans and how we treat migrants, for example, right? And how we refuse to enter a migrant community, we refuse to enter migrant villages because we deem that maybe sanitarily they're not taking care well of. We would somehow, and I remember seeing a video once where somebody wanted to interact with a migrant, but then was very averse to even shaking hands because they're afraid of some sort of germs, some sort of bacteria and germs, like, transmitted via handshake.
I mean, earlier this year when we had the whole, it wasn't earlier this year, it was around the middle of this year when we had the whole panic about what to do about Rohingyas, especially as they were actually hovering not far from our coast. You see the same sort of reactions. And in fact, when I think about abjection in a social sense, that example came to mind the most vividly. And of course, it wasn't talking about filth in terms, like you said, it's not about talking about porcine or animals eating out of trash. It's not that kind of disgust, but a certain disgust at what these people looked like. People saying how they had not showered, how they all looked desperate. There, the abject takes on a different register. You know, it becomes about how they are human, but in a way that doesn't fit our preferences of what's clean and what's orderly and what's neat and what's presentable to our eyes.
I see this reflected a lot in how we talk about certain places, like I remember reading this one large comic where the Singaporean Prime Minister of then, Lee Kuan Yew, was looking towards his glasses, was looking towards binoculars towards Malaysia, towards what seems to be Malaysia, and he says, "Wow, this place looks really dirty. This must be Malaysia." But then his secretary corrects him and says, "Actually, there's Little India looking at, and that was in Singapore." This view that the other, the community which deem unclean, is not normal to them, and it just dehumanizes, I think, that community in that sense.
I think we've listed some very relevant examples to the Malaysian context of how objections come out to play. And one of the things that struck me as we were listing these cases down was just how 2015, if we really want to apply some cultural theory to it, especially in Malaysia, has been the year of objection, right? If you just think about the DNA Babi issue, the refugee crisis, and separate trolleys. These are moments when objection comes out to play. Let's talk more about the depths of objection, the second part of the show, and really reflect on why is it that it really grips us. But for now, let's take a break. And I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, joined this week by Azif Aizuddin, and this is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. Alongside me this week is Azif Aizuddin, standing in for Sharat Kutin, and we've been discussing abjection. Somehow, it's occurred to us that Malaysia has a lot of examples for that. I want to touch on Kristeva's theory in a bit more detail, because I think she lays out in quite systematic ways how we can better make sense of this.
I think the first question for us, at least, is why do we naturally feel disgust towards something which we are not culturally trained to do so? Right? How does a young kid who maybe at the age of 4 and 3 would look at maybe a migrant worker in disgust without even being taught that the migrant worker was unclean for that matter?
And that's one of the interesting things about Kristeva's theory, right? That we can extend it to prejudices, like you said, you know, the kind of uneasiness we have in our society towards things that are unfamiliar, but more particularly things that have been construed as dirty. And a couple of interesting things here. The first is that a lot of times there's a primal element to this. Somebody who does not like a migrant worker might not even use the word dirty, might not even use the word filth. But the reaction indicates repulsion or rejection. The second thing is that for Kristeva, this is something very human. So one of the things that I do want to underscore, because we're listing a lot of examples that are close to home, that this is not necessarily an Islamic thing or a Malay thing or a Malaysian thing, but that the idea of being human itself requires abjection. Let me explain it so that this can be clearer. One of the things that we do need to do in becoming civilized, quote unquote, in having rationality, in having language, in having ethics and culture, is to demarcate spaces. What is ours and what is theirs, for example. What's inside and what is outside. And Kristeva points this as having origins in our encounter with abjection, because it is the abject, that moment when we are in our full bodily state, when we are in a fully vulnerable state in the arms of our mother, when we are not really caring about where we defecate, where we pee, that we must escape from, or what we must somehow leave in order to become orderly and civilized. So the key implication here is that we cannot be quote-unquote human in that way without rejecting our so-called natural bond that we had prior to becoming organized and orderly and civilized.
So basically we win some and we lose some, right? Basically we gain society, we gain civility, but we also lose that aspect which is quite a pretty natural to our beings, at least when we were younger. But for me, it begs the question, right, that when we develop this sort of prejudice, I think, for example, is what was discussed, I think, a lot this year as well, was this how we perceive the homeless, the destitute, migrants for that matter. And it seems that a lot of people, it is a large number of them, feel uneasy in going down to the streets and actually really fully engaging and interacting with these people, helping them out of that economic bubble, right? The economic status that they're in. And this mostly comes out of the fact that they feel disgust mm-hmm. in dealing with these people. In mm-hmm. fact, even if we see, I think what was the most interesting that last year I went down to for this one soup kitchen event, and what was interesting, what the way in which the social workers were handing out food was not really treating these people as though they're human per se. I mean, there was empathy there too, mm-hmm. but it seems like there is a social positioning that is already very apparent there, where the homeless are seen as people who are expecting from them socially lower in that sense, and they're being treated, I guess, crudely, I would say, as though they're animals to be fed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why for many people, and maybe I'm like this a lot of the times, charity is much easier. You just pay somebody to do the job, right? Mm. Because like you say, going down to where these problems are, and typically they're not pleasant places, demands too much of our very measured and very controlled sort of common sense, right? But what Kristeva presents is an explanation of why. You know, the reason why it hits us at our gut, it hits us at our throats, right? It's pretty rational. It's because we've had to make that break from the maternal body in order to gain that sort of control that being human entails. I would even point out this tendency lately for more gated communities in Malaysia. And I don't just mean the luxury gated communities, right? Because there are even middle-class neighborhoods that are employing them right now. And I wonder sometimes if the greater problems that we face as a nation, you know, whether it's the worsening economy leading to rising crimes or the need for cheap labor bringing in more, you know, the poor from different countries to work here, mm-hmm. is generating an atmosphere of greater insecurity, you know. And this is translated in spatial terms, at least, in these gated communities where there is this us versus them, us in our controlled environment with security, and the jungle out there, which is unpredictable and scary and disorderly, you know.
Mm-hmm. But this reminds me a lot of something I was thinking over a lot over the weekend, actually, where, perhaps you can correct me on this one, but if you drive down to Shah Alam, I noticed that the federal highway, when you talk about spatial dimensions, right, the federal highway divides what seems to be a more middle and upper class community on the administrative side of things, where students, families and residentials and administrators live, whereas on the other side there is the more wilder side of Shah Alam, where factories are, where migrants live, where I think the community is much more rich and robust, but viewed as perhaps a little less above the social class that exists on the administrative side, right? Mm-hmm. And we can see how Paranjawa itself is placed on that side mm-hmm, mm-hmm. of the divide, or the federal highway divide.
That's a very insightful observation. And of course, what's on the other side, the industrial side of Shah Alam, is the Carlsberg factories.
Yes.
Right?
Where it's considered unclean anyway, in a sense.
It's considered unclean, right? And it's part of, like you said, the industrial working class there. And of course, mainstream Shah Alam is where order and power is. But you're right, it is divided by the highway. And that's where the lake is, mm-hmm. and that's where the houses are, the universities.
For me, so then does that mean that abjection not only comes down to our interaction, physical interactions, but also our architectural and spatial interactions?
Yes. In fact, if you read Kristeva in the opening of The Powers of Horror, it is replete with frontier metaphors, the idea of drawing lines, the idea of demarcation, the idea that there is an inside and an outside, the idea that we are to construct borders in order to affirm who we are. And that's something we often take for granted, the idea that our self-affirmation always requires a certain rejection of others. So good rejects bad, civilized rejects uncivilized, man is opposed to women. There's always this opposition at play. But what Kristeva shows is that abjection and the self also requires an outside. And one of the interesting things about Kristeva is that she points out that there is this pull towards the abject. Like you say, there is, you know, these two sides of Shah Alam. And the fact that we're comparing it is very interesting too, that we are curious about what that side is really like. You know, I'm on the, you know, as the listeners can tell, I'm from the masjid side of Shah Alam, you know, so the big masjid. So another example that you gave, horror films. Why do people go to horror films, right? When there's going to be grime, you know, let's say if it's the serial killer uses a chainsaw, you are going to watch a chainsaw murder scene. a lot of people might close their eyes, but they're still there. They bring themselves close to these things. Because for Kristeva, our contact with the abject has had fuller forms, especially in the materiality of our adolescent bodies, right? That was when before we gained consciousness, we were just this bodily thing absorbing the world. That we didn't care if it was dirty, we'd poop wherever, we'd pee wherever. And we actually had fun in that thing, right? So that is the earliest roots of our abjection. And no matter how much we try to construct clean and proper egos, these moments of abjection will always have some kind of a hold in our unconscious.
You know what reminds me of that? It reminds me of Mark Twain's novel, The Prince and the Pauper, where this young prince disguised himself, in fact, exchanged places with this young poor boy and spends time interacting and living among the destitute in order to feel the realness, right? And I think that's a certain fascination from those, perhaps from the upper middle class, in order to go out into the world, go out to streets, be part of what they should be abjecting in order to feel like they're part of the real world. And I'm not sure where that comes from, though.
No, correct. Or it creeps up in the way we talk, you know? Like when you do hard work, you talk about getting your hands dirty. Hmm. Or sexual fetishes. In those zones of intimacy and bodily inhibitions, suddenly whatever's dirty is indulged in. And in that moment, it's acceptable, it's even celebrated in some cases, and it gets indulged in. These moments shows the limits of the kind of ego we construct, the one that always wants order, rationality, coherence, and recognizability. Human beings require these moments because there is that very primal pull towards the materiality of existence, which is the body. But not just the body in an abstract form, the body in its organic and real form. It's sometimes it's wet, sometimes it's rough and dry, but in every case, there is that contact with the matter that is who we are, right? Not just individuals who are rational, but individuals who are embodied and has an animal side.
Mm-hmm. Well, most of our examples seem to be centered around social classes, right? Where the upper middle class maybe not want to interact with those outside their circle or below their circle. But for me, I'm just wondering, right? Do those from the lower middle class or perhaps the migrants perhaps feel the similar objection to the upper middle class and the privileged?
Doesn't necessarily have to go in sort of complementary opposites, right? But it is there even among those who may be at the margins. And I think the examples we use are examples that we're comfortable speaking of as privileged people, right? Mm-hmm. Because I can't pull out examples from, say, a factory worker in Shah Alam because I don't know, I wouldn't know. But for Kristeva, for as long as there is this transition from our so-called bodily and more natural, quote-unquote, animal state to this orderly, civilized character, for as long as there is that transition, we'll always be, quote-unquote, haunted by the abject. And in that, there'll be this ambivalent pull and push. You know, times when we really reject it to be fully idealized as human beings, and times when we're drawn to it when we can no longer hold on to the ideal because we know there's a different side to it, which is abject. Azif, before we started the show, you mentioned this curious example of a paper that you read that referenced the, you know, harm or injuries against pregnant women as an example of the abject. Can you just share that to the listeners, please?
Okay, so there's research out there. In fact, many different research papers out there that talks about intimate male partner violence towards their pregnant partners, right? Their pregnant women partners. And it's interesting because the WHO has even stepped up to have a Make Pregnancies Safer campaign. Mm-hmm. And the idea here is that a lot of these women suffer violence towards their bodies, not necessarily a hit, but towards their bodies. Because the idea here is that, you know, male partners become violent as a consequence of a desire to destroy the presence of the other, as in the unborn child or the imagined child that occupies the space that is owned by them. So men who feel like they own their women's bodies, and then suddenly a child, an alien being sort, grows into the mother's wombs. Mm-hmm. And that's where men feel left out, because now the woman is giving attention, bodily attention and whatsoever, towards this child. And they suffer, these men at least suffer from frustrated sexual desire. And I guess we can draw that back to perhaps Lacan and Freud, in where we will always feel attached to our mother, right? Mm-hmm. And there's this break here. Mm-hmm. Why they do it is to exert control through violence, to dehumanize and to objectify. And the idea is to limit the autonomy of women. So you can see how the men would start isolating the women from their social connections, how they would start not even giving, in the Malay term is nafkah, giving money to the women in order to support themselves. And the idea is to turn them into something alien.
That's really fascinating, Azif. And since we're ending the show soon, and typically we end with recommendations, could you tell us the title and the author of that paper? Because I think it's interesting to look up.
Mm-hmm. So it's a 2009 study paper called Against Objection, Against Abjection, Violent Disgust and the Maternal. It's written by Imogen Tyler.
Okay, cool. And is that easily Googleable?
Easily Googleable, yes.
Oh, awesome. I'll look that up. My recommendation is to check out the book itself. Also, I think easily Googleable. It's called Powers of Horror, An Essay on Abjection. And that's by Julia Kristeva. And I feel that it's rather digestible read, you know. And at times I lose track because she's referring a lot of novelists I haven't read. But they're really, really interesting gems there. And I think there are insights there that can connect with a lot of the stuff we talked about, especially in Malaysia. There's a lot of differences, right, culturally, linguistically. And add to that an uncertain economy, there's greater insecurities and need to demarcate. And sometimes being overwhelmed in that process will lead us to label some people to be ascribed, you know, abjection or abjected labels and qualities. At any rate, you're always welcome to write to us. Just email us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com or add us on Facebook. Just look up BFM Night School on the search space and send us a message there. Be sure to like that page too. And as usual, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. Interestingly, I feel the best experience to listen to this show is as you drive down through Shah Alam on Federal Highway.
And just see the difference on your left and right side.
On your left and on your right, and then think of Malaysian politics. And I think you'll get the most out of this episode. I hope you enjoyed the discussion and you can look up the text we recommended. And for now, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat alongside Azif Azuddin. And this is Night School on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.